Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 149, recorded April 28th, 2014. Dana Boyd. Triangulation is brought to you by Nature Box, where you can order great-tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine. Get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like blueberry almond bites. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/triangulation. And by LegalZoom. Visit LegalZoom.com to save on your legal needs and gain access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. LegalZoom's not a law firm. They provide self-help services at your specific direction. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code TRIANGULATION to receive $10 off at checkout. It's time for Triangulation, the show on Twit where we talk to some of the smartest, most interesting people who make their way in the world of technology. And I'm thrilled. I've been wanting to get Dana Boyd on this show for many, many years. She's always been one of the most interesting researchers in the area of social media, and particularly how kids, teens, relate to social media. She's written a new book. It's called It's Complicated, nicely titled, The Social Lives of Network Teens. Dana, it's so nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to say something, Chad, though. You've got to make her name all lowercase on the lower thirds there. We want to spell it the way Dana does. Why do you do that? Are you like E.E. Cummings, right?
No, actually, E.E. actually never did it except for in his books. It's more like Bell Hooks, who was really interested in it as a very intentional act. Yeah. But my mother was obsessed with typography, and so my mother did it. It's the reason I have an H at the end of my name, and my name is all sorts of fun and balanced.
Oh, that's really interesting. So it's on your birth certificate, all lowercase.
Well, no, my birth certificate is like yours, which is in all capital letters.
Oh, okay.
But all my legal documents that are signed and different things where it shows the actual spelling or capitalization, that's where you see it lowercase.
Your mom sounds like an interesting person.
She's wonderful.
Yeah. So Dana is a principal researcher at Microsoft Research, a research professor in media, culture, and communication at NYU, a fellow at the very famous Berkman Center at Harvard. And really, whenever we're trying to understand how kids, teens particularly, relate to the internet, we go to Dana Boyd. Why is it you've kept your youthfulness so you can talk to teens?
It's funny because in the tech sector, everybody thinks I'm so young, but teenagers look at me and they're like, "You're ancient."
Old
like,
lady.
Thanks.
Yeah.
That feels great. But no, I think part of it was that I was among the first generation of young people who really grew up online, and I appreciated it for all of the opportunities that I had as a teenager. And so I went back to look at what had changed, and part of it was that it had gone mainstream, right? When I was a teen and when we were online, we were all self-identified geeks, freaks, and queers, and I was all three, so the internet felt like home.
But that's this not would, where wait a minute, this would days. Have been the 80s. You were online in the 80s? Oh, no,
no,
I guess it was the 90s. 90s. Okay.
Yeah,
I made you
10
years older. Okay. So you were very early on the internet. I mean, the Netscape came out in 95, or 94. So this is
94.
even before then.
Yeah, no, it was before that. And part of it was my brother had, the internet because he was doing different kinds of coding and software development. And he did the terrible thing of using up the phone line. And as a teenage girl, I was like, what are you doing? Why is it making beeps and squeakly sounds? And this is crazy. And he helped me realize that the internet was made of people. And all of a sudden, the internet became much more interesting.
Dana, I'm downloading Doom. Stop it. Stop picking up the phone. So there wasn't really anything like social media in the 90s. I guess there were bulletin boards,
well,
BBSs.
Yeah, it was BBSs. It was Usenet. It was different mailing lists. In fact, I actually spent my teen years talking to strangers in an era in which people didn't think that was such a big deal, right? Because you know, if you were using a computer, it had to be educational. Why else were you on a computer? And so for me, it was, you know, I spent my late nights talking to strangers around the world. And there were some tremendously memorable conversations. For example, I had a phenomenal conversation with a young man who was in Iraq. This was, of course, during the first Gulf War, helping me understand what the military was like. And, you know, as a teen, I expected to go into the military. So having these conversations were truly eye-opening.
Wow. Were you on IRC?
Yep. Went through IRC and then, you know, made my first homepage, you know, shortly after Mozilla came out. And part of it was really funny because I was, of course, you know, quickly created a lyrics page for my favorite musician, which is Ani DeFranco, which I have scarily been maintaining for all these years.
You still maintain an Ani DeFranco lyrics
page?
I love it.
And so all these people run into me. They're like, "Hey, I know you from like, you know, 20 years ago." And I'm like, "Great."
What was your first? I want to see if the Wayback Machine has your first website. Have you looked?
Well, the first one was on you know, different kinds of GeoCities, and then it was you know, a CMU server because I spent a summer at CMU. But the place where it really started to get maintained would have been in 1996, which is when I put it on the Brown server, and then I moved it to dana.org. I'm not sure, maybe 97? And then, you know, the scary thing is I've also been blogging since 1997.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're an old timer.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't called blogging at that time, obviously. But I literally remember, you know, implementing, you know, forward and back buttons. And I remember building out a calendar because I hated tables. Nothing was worse than trying to implement tables in HTML.
But your experience, I think, with the internet is very, very different than my kids, who are now 22
Absolutely.
And 19. Because they didn't do back buttons. They didn't even do a blog. They didn't need to. They had Instagram. They had my daughter, because she's 22, she started with Instant Messenger. She was never the teenager on the phone all the time. She was the teenager who had IM running at all times. And it's funny because even though they're 2 years apart, the change between what she did and what my son did is huge. So she was on IM all the time. He had Skype running all the time, videos going. Of course, both of them had music running in the background on iTunes at all times, trying. They were very good. They were doing their homework. And his parents were going, what? Knock it off up there. So it changes, and now it changes at a pace that's pretty speedy.
Well, certainly the technology's changed, right? But the underlying practices are surprisingly pretty common. So, you know, like you point out, teenagers are theoretically doing their homework while engaging with every form of media that would be more entertaining and more social than their homework
yes,
is.
Yes.
And, you know, for my cohort, of course, it was MTV, you know, on TV at the same time that you would play the radio, right?
Yeah.
Because clearly that made sense.
Yeah.
You know, and you would be talking on the phone with your friends. Of course, at the time it was a landline.
Right.
You know, and that was really common. And so we see that same practice. It's just new technologies, you know, that have inflected it in funny ways. But part of it, of course, is recognizing that there are a variety of differences amongst young people depending on where they fit into their whole social world. So when my cohort was online, like those of us who were online, we were not the cool kids.
You were the geeks.
We were the geeks.
Right.
And, you know, now, you know, everybody is using technology and it's no big deal. That doesn't mean the geeks have suddenly become, you know, cool in their technology use. They're just engaging in technology use that looks very different than the mainstream teens.
Your previous book was called Hanging Out, Messing Around, and Geeking Out, Kids Living and Learning with New Media. So clearly this has been going on for a while. I was talking to Richard Hart a couple of years ago. He was the host on CNET and did Next Step or Next, What's Next, something like that. It was a TV show. So he was very technically literate, was teaching. He was teaching at a college in San Francisco at the time, just a couple of years ago. And I said, boy, it must be great, you know, to work now with kids who are so technically literate. He says, actually, it's quite the opposite. We and our generation had to learn how to use this stuff. We became deeply involved. We did back buttons. Kids that grew up with it, it's just a presence. They don't know any more about it than they do about a toaster or a microwave oven.
Absolutely. And I think this is why I get so frustrated with language like digital natives, because there's this assumption that, you know, technological skill just sort of comes down from the sky, right? That if you have technology and you use it, you must know, you know, every detail about it. the teenagers that I meet, most of them can't even, you know, construct a search query and understand how the algorithms of a search engine work, let alone, you know, build something as simple as HTML or something more sophisticated using, you know, higher languages. So part of it is really tricky because we assume that young people's comfort with using these tools translates into their, you know, comfort with building them, and that's just not true. That said, there are an amazing number of young people who are, you know, the geeks of their cohort. And I think that one of the things I've been most intrigued by is how that plays out amongst the hacking youth. So my, you know, cohort of friends, when I was growing up, we were hackers. We got ourselves into lots of trouble.
Right.
And that was pretty common of geeks of that era. But most of us were trying to hack security systems, right? Just to prove that we could, to prove that we were smarter than, say, the Navy. And so we broke into their systems, and it was really funny. What was interesting to me with the teens that I met who were of the same ilk is that instead of trying to hack the security economy, they were trying to hack the attention economy.
Yes.
And, you know, nowhere is this more visible than watching 4chan kids. You know, and of course, if you don't know what 4chan is, don't look it up.
Our audience does, believe me. They,
I'm sure they do.
Half of them are on /B/B.
Yeah. So the thing about, you know, the thing about kids that grew up in B, you know, on 4chan is that they started messing with these larger systems just to prove that they could. And of course, you know, I was absolutely
for the
delighted
lulls.
Watching for the lulls. And, you know, I was delighted watching them play with, like, say, Oprah, right? There's nothing funnier than to get Oprah to talk about something panicky from the internet that she doesn't understand. Like, it's just entertaining, right? So when she's, you know, talking about pedo bear as the next, you know, great threat to childhood, of course, everybody's having a field day, right? Yeah. Or when Time Magazine thinks that they can outsmart a group of, you know, young people and make certain that, you know, they can control who's hacking their list of most influential people, without realizing that they just printed, you know, a message on their paper that says, you know, marble cake also you know, also the joke or something, also the fun, for, you know, also the game. That's what it was.
Right.
Right. It's fun. And that to me is the same, you know, mindset.
Absolutely.
Now, of course, what this means is that all of a sudden you see Anonymous, you see WikiLeaks, you see, you know, a question of Snowden, and you see, you know, a rising up of a certain kind of technologically sophisticated resistance. But this is not mainstream youth. This is the same edge cases as, you know, were the geeks in my cohort.
They're disenfranchised. They're not part of mainstream society.
Well, you know, they don't feel like they fit in, and part of it is technology is a place where they find that they can have some form of power. But the stakes are very different than when my cohort was playing with this, right? You know, some of my friends got caught. Actually, many of them did. And, you know, very few of them had internet access, you know, by the end of high school.
Yeah.
And, of course, some of them had to, you know, go work for the Navy for a couple of years, right? And that was the debt you paid for being a punk. You know, what we're seeing of hackers of today is a very different kind of debt that they're expected to pay. And, you know, and they're at this point going away to, you know, doing jail time that's a lot longer than, you know, rapists and murderers in this country, right? And that's pretty terrifying to watch as that plays out.
And yet it's also very complicated. I think of the case of Weave, who was just recently released on a technicality. He was a self-proclaimed troll and totally terrified Kathy Sierra. And yet he was also this hacker that kind of, by using a flaw in AT&T's system, was able to show, you know, how poorly designed it was in the iPad. And it's not black and white. It's complicated.
No, and, you know, many of, you know, those who engage in hacking at that high end, they're not always such nice people. Mm-hmm. But the question is, are they going to jail because they're mean and cruel people, or are they going to jail because they engaged in something that was illegal in a particular way, right? And this is where it gets really ugly to figure these things out.
And because society is, frankly, scared of them. I mean, Aaron absolutely. Schwartz... Weave, these people terrify the FBI. They terrify mainstream society. They're not understood. We don't get their motivation, and we're terrified about their skill.
Yeah, and that's where, I mean, this is hacktivist culture, right? They're resisting a certain kind of norms that aren't being called into question by other folks, right? Especially around technology. And that's where it's, this question for me is like, you know, what does contemporary activism look like? How do we resist or call into question or challenge the kinds of things that we see in our society that we don't like? And there's always been a small subslice of, you know, the technological elite for whom that's been a very important value for them, is to just, you know, really to call out these, you know, normative assumptions.
Right.
And I think that that's one of the things we often forget, especially as, you know, technology becomes cool and, you know, it's contemporary Wall Street and all of these other facets that are going on in our industry, is that there still is a component of folks that really come out of this from a wanting to change the world for the better kind of way. And sometimes their tactics aren't always so lovely.
We're talking to Dana Boyd. This is such a treat to talk to you. Her newest book, which just came out, is called It's Complicated, taken, of course, from one of the relationship choices, one of many now on Facebook. For most of us, it was the only one for a long time you could choose. We're going to talk more about the book and about what your research tells us about the youth of America, the youth of today.
Kids these days.
Kids these days. What is going on, Dana Boyd? In just a minute. Of course, you know, many of the people watching this show are those kids going, "What, dude.
Yeah, what's that funny old lady saying?
What are they talking about, man? I got to hack this IRC, man." We're going to come back with more in just a bit. But for snack time, where's my nature box? Nature box, please. I love a sponsor that feeds you. Nature Box is better snacks than the kind you might get if at around about 2 in the afternoon you get a little peckish. It's right about now, right? And you want to go, you go down the hall to the snack machine. What do they got there? A bunch of candy bars? No. We're talking good stuff. This is stuff designed by nutritionists. Nutritionist approved. There are no HFCs in here. There's never any hydrogenated oils or artificial sweeteners. Zero trans fats. No artificial flavors or colors. Always delicious snacks full of energy. Whole wheat raspberry figgy bars, anyone? Look at these. These are great. Now, here's the beauty of this. You can get this delivered to your door every month. Three different sizes, small, medium, and large. And we're going to get you half off your first box so you can get an idea of what NatureBox has to offer if you visit naturebox.com/twit. Sour cream and onioned almonds. How about that? Big Island pineapple. You can also, by the way, narrow it down. So if you want gluten-free or vegan, savory, sweet, or spicy, you could say, only give me that. They have hundreds of different snacks to choose from. Pistachio power clusters. These are my favorite. Santa Fe corn sticks. Blueberry almond bites. Dvorak was here yesterday. He stole my whole nature box. He just took the whole thing away. But that's all right. We've got more. Choose the nature box you want or get an assortment to get a sense of all the different flavors and get half off. Naturebox.com/twit. Use the offer code TWIT. And but I got to warn you, you're going to get hooked. The first one's half off, but then the rest, well, you're going to have to pay for those. Dana Boyd is our guest. Her new book, It's Complicated, The Social Life of Lives of Networked Teens. You are now the go-to person when people go, what's going on, those crazy kids today? And I always think about Bye Bye Birdie, which was the movie with Anne Margaret that kind of showed me as a growing up teenager what teenagers were supposed to be like. She was on the phone and the wire was all wrapped around and kicking up her legs. And it's changed so much. But what you're saying is that there's some eternal truths to how teens interact and network.
Well, I wouldn't say it's always eternal. There's actually some really interesting cycles to it all. But the kinds of practices that we're seeing today aren't new.
They're not so different.
They're not so different. So let's, you know, think about it in terms of an American context, right? You know, from the, you know, following the World War II up through the 70s, it was really common for middle and upper class young people to be able to go and have as much freedom as they could find, right?
Boy, that's changed. That's how I grew up. And people of my cohort say, oh, yeah, we walked 3 miles to school. We could go around, you know, go anywhere downtown. We did crazy things. And now there's predators all of a sudden and you can't go out the door.
And that's the funny thing, is that we've done a lot of fear-mongering, and it really started in the 80s. And part of it started because there was, you know, 24/7 news. And 24/7 news meant we were convinced that every terrible thing happening in the world was happening in our back door, our backyard. And so, you know, we created all of these changes in the 80s, right? Curfew laws, loitering laws, trespassing laws, you know, restrictions about latchkey kids, the idea that kids shouldn't take school buses to school, on top of things like suburbanization, which meant that your, you know, your friends lived much further away. All of these changes happened really beginning in the 80s. And of course, it was a collective action puzzle, which is that even if you could get out and, you know, hang out with your friends, it didn't mean your friends could. And so the result is that when the internet came along, why sneak out, right? Like, why not just go and find your friends online? And you knew that they were there, and not just your closest and dearest, but your all your friends. And so what we see teenagers are doing there is the same thing that my cohort did in the mall, right? Hanging out, joking around, messing with each other, you know, gossiping, flirting, you know, good and bad, right? Teenagers are still teenagers, and they still do dumb things. And they're doing those dumb things online, which is part of what makes adults really panic, because they see the traces of it and they get concerned, right? They can get concerned about the long-term implications. They get concerned that more people can see it. But they don't realize that we've created this through a whole set of decisions that we made. And the teens that I meet, they'd much rather get together in person. They'd much rather hang out with their friends without parents lurking. But they don't feel like they have that choice. And so the thing is that they've gone to the internet because it's a relief valve.
Yeah. There is this moral panic, though, as soon as this happens. I'm sorry. I don't know what's going on with this mic. I apologize. But as soon as this happens, we adults go, the internet. Oh, my God.
It's the new thing that we love to blame, and we love to blame it for all of societal ills rather than actually recognizing that it's just making things more visible, right? Take something like the conversation about bullying. You know, many adults are surprised to find out that we haven't seen a rise in bullying in the last 30 years, right? It's been pretty consistent. And even more, you know, notably is that young people continue to report that it's far worse at school, with greater emotional duress, with more serious consequences. So what gives, right? Of course, on one hand, you know, parents immediately jump on the fact that, you know, it extends what happens in school into the home. And that's true. But so does it extend the emotional support, which means that teens are looking out for, you know, the ways in which their friends are there for them, not just the way in which the mean people are also there. But there's also some really weird twists to this, right? We often, you know, turn to things like Ask.fm or, you know, Formspring as these terrible evils. And, you know, I hear news coverage about these sites all the time. But the funny thing about these question and answer services is that, you know, you have to actually choose to answer an anonymous question before it becomes visible on your site.
Wait a minute.
So my question is,
local news is demonizing Formspring? What?
Oh, it's been all over the place, right? They're blamed for all sorts of young people's suicides.
Because there's bullying on Formspring?
Because there's a lot of meanness and cruelty that takes place on it.
Dear.
But the shocking thing is, a lot of it's self-bullying. Teenagers will actually anonymously ask themselves horrible questions. In order to then show that they're strong and that they can handle it, but also because their friends come back and say lots of good things to them.
Oh, my God.
So these things are more strange than we often realize.
It's very complicated. So, let's bust some myths, as you do in the book. Are predators rampant on the internet?
No, I mean, that was, in some ways it's easy, but in some ways it's hard, right? Which is that, you know, you'll often hear an ad council will repeat this number, 1 in 5 or 1 in 7 young people are sexually solicited online.
Right.
That's work that comes from the Crimes Against Children Research Center, which is a phenomenal research center run by David Finkelhor. What people don't realize, because nobody reads the report, is that that is almost all sexual solicitations are from other young people or from, you know, 18 to 20 four-year-olds. Those who come from older are very rare. And oddly enough, most young people aren't concerned about them. So then you have to try to untangle that and see what's going on. And of course, when we look at crimes against children that involve sex and the internet, what we find is that it's often the case that young people are portraying themselves as older, seeking out sexual contact with older people, doing so with, you know, lying about their age, and they know it's about sex. They meet up knowing it's about sex, and they do so repeatedly, believing they're in love. It's deeply problematic, and there's a reason why statutory rape is a violation of the law in this country. But the thing is the issue is more messy than we realize, because these are young people who are really at risk. Right?
Anyway,
they are
at home.
They often are from abusive
situations.
Mall,
everywhere. Not just,
they're often from abusive situations, right. Mental health struggles, sexuality issues,
right.
A whole variety of issues where you can see they're crying out for help.
Yeah.
And so we then go back and try to blame the technology where actually, you know, we need to find those young people and help them because their parents are often not the people that are good citizens or around in meaningful ways. And I think this is where I get frustrated because we keep wanting to create laws to stop, you know, the internet, hoping that that will stop the problem rather than getting at the crux of the problem. And furthermore, most, you know, young people who will be sexually victimized by their peers. right? And those who are victimized by adults will be victimized by the people in their community. So if we get lost and distracted by the internet, we don't help the majority of young people who are really desperate for a lot of help. And, you know, it's really sad. And so I use this as a moment to say, hey, why are we paying so much attention to the boogeyman rather than helping young people who are really hurting? And even those who are most likely to be victimized online, we could do a lot by really looking for them, identifying them, making certain that they get access to social services. And we do a terrible job of that in this country.
I mean, of course, you're talking to a bunch of geeks. Our audience is technically literate. So they know this, but I want to give them some ammunition and raise some awareness about where the real problem lies. What do we do about that? I mean, the internet does give us an opportunity. For a lot of kids who are marginalized, the internet is their first safe place they can be.
Yep. Well, and I think that's where we've seen some shifts, right? It used to be that you could actually get a lot of support online, and that's not true for a lot of young people these days.
Oh, really?
Okay. And part of it is that we've spent so much time, you know, fearing strangers.
Yeah.
Nowhere is that more visible than LGBT youth, right? You know, as a queer kid coming out online, the internet was awesome. It was so supportive. That's not what LGBT youth experience today. They get, you know, hate all over YouTube. Whenever they come out online, they get attacked in their home communities. People aren't there to support them. That's really sad to me.
It's very disappointing.
And for a lot of the geeks, you know, that are listening to this, part of it, of course, is that this was a home turf for them, right? To find other people who shared their passions, mm-hmm. which was great. But part of it is also we get to see people who are really struggling whenever we're online, right? You know, when we're building these systems, we see people who are, you know, hurting all over the place. And this is where I think that we have to figure out how to get creative in order to help them. You know, for example, I'm on the board of an organization called Crisis Text Line, which is a service that allows young people who are in crisis to text with counselors. And it's a phenomenal service where we see young people who are really crying out for help. It's one of those things that, you know, I strongly encourage people who are building, you know, social systems to link to what, you know, on pages that might be, you know, are you struggling? Are you hurting? What's going on, right? Whether it's a matter of search queries or whether it's a matter of content that they're seeing or even something as simple as, you know, the fact page. Because there's ways of connecting, you know, young people to people who can help them. But social services are not where we're seeing that happen right now. The other thing is that I would love to see more geeks out there helping educate people about what's happening with technology, right? In some ways, you know, we kind of avoid that kind of educational mandate. We hope that other people will figure it out because we're building cool systems. But these systems now have a lot of power, you know, in our society and are used by a much broader swath of people than we ever would have imagined when we were building them 20 years ago, which means that we have to think about how to make certain that people are informed about what's going on, you know, whether we're starting with, you know, regulators and judges, whether we're talking about journalists, you know. And it's a moment of taking a step back and saying, hey, we have a responsibility to create a society that's more, you know, literate about algorithms, literate about data usage, literate about, you know, the kinds of systems that we build, because we can't just assume that people will suddenly wake up one day and understand these systems.
We're talking with Dana Boyd. You wrote a great article in Quartz when the Oculus Rift was sold to Facebook about your studies with this kind of virtual reality stuff and gender differences. I think that's really interesting. I want to talk about that in just a second. So many things to talk about. Her new book is called It's Complicated. Cory Doctorow says must read It's Complicated. And if Cory says you got to read something, you got to read, then that's serious, okay? We'll have more in just a second. Our show today brought to you by Personal Capital. A really interesting response from Silicon Valley, a startup that responds to this issue of how do you keep track of your money in a way that makes sense so you can plan for your future. And I think there's maybe some people think, oh, there's a little something about, oh, I don't want to keep track of my money. That would mean that money was important. You know what? Nobody's got to take care of you in your old age. Maybe if you're lucky, somebody will. But I think it's probably a good idea to plan for the future now. There's a lot of issues with keeping track of your money. Of course, everybody's got a different website, so you've got a bunch of logins for your stocks, your 401k, your bank accounts, your charge cards, your mortgage, your loans, different usernames, different passwords. You can't see it all at once. That's one thing Personal Capital does right away, is just put this all together so you can see with very clear dashboards, graphs on your iPad, your iPhone, your Android device, your desktop, what's going on with your money. That's really important. You can also see where you're overpaying for financial advice or financial fees and where you can save money. And this is a very useful tool. You'll get tailored advice based on the information you've given them on how to optimize your investments, how to save money, how to plan for your future, how to grow your piggy bank into something useful. I really like it. Best of all, this is free. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. We had Bill Harris, the founder of Personal Capital, on the show a couple of years ago. He was former CEO at PayPal and Intuit. And I think he learned there what people really need when it comes to keeping track of their money. He's got a great site. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. We thank them for their support of Triangulation. Dana Boyd is our guest. What do you do at Microsoft? You're a researcher at Microsoft. What does that mean?
So Microsoft Research is an amazing institution. It's very academic in nature. It's one of the great industrial research labs, right? Like Bell Labs or Xerox Park, these kinds of things. And you know, it's about 1,000 PhDs strong, most of whom are computer scientists. And I have the great fortune to help, you know, create a social science team in the New England lab and really think through what are the different kind of socio-technical issues that are emerging. Because if we want to build, you know, powerful systems, we need to make certain that we understand what's playing out and why it's playing out the way it is. But it's sort of a funny, quirky place. And I don't see much investment from the tech industry these days in this kind of basic research. And I feel very lucky to be in a place that really supports it. And I'm grateful to Microsoft for continuing that investment.
Good. When you were at Brown, you studied computer science as an undergraduate. You wrote your thesis on 3D computer systems and how they are inherently sexist.
So it was
what?
It was a very funny project. So my background was graphics, and I was working for a very renowned professor named Andy Van Damme, and we used to get into these great playful fights, and he had just invested in building this immersive 3D system called The Cave, and he wanted me to check it out, and I jumped in, and I immediately lost my lunch.
Cave was amazing.
Cave was, I'm sure other people loved it. I was intrigued by it in theory, and in reality, it was not the thing for me. And so I marched out in my very punk way. I sort of looked at Andy, and I'm like, this thing is sexist. And he looked at me and goes, prove it. And I was like, okay.
Good
and
professor. So I ended up, that's a good professor. I love it.
Oh, yeah. We had a lot of fun playing with each other and just sort of being like, I can prove you wrong. I will prove you wrong. So I ended up on this crazy research project in part because, you know, I kept watching a lot of the other women who were computer graphics experts fail at very basic tasks. And at the time, the rhetoric was that, oh, it's due to women not having experience or exposure with technology. And I'm like, these women are all rock star computer scientists. Like, this is not what's going on here. And I found a footnote in an old military report that said women seem to get simulator sickness going into 3D immersive environments, but they will eventually adjust. And then when they adjust, they get sick going back into reality.
So I was like, oh, great.
That's strange. So I was trying to uncover all of this. And so I ended up on this crazy path where I was ended up in Utrecht working in a gender clinic as people were transitioning from male to female and female to male, looking at how basic depth cue changes were occurring. And I was, that's intriguing. And then I ended up running a series of experiments in a very sort of pilot study kind of program where I was looking at what happened when you put two cues into conflict, two vision depth cues into conflict, and found that there was a difference in terms of what men and women would prioritize. And, you know, the challenge with it was that I was able to do, you know, some level of basic research at that point, but I could never get the full answers on what I was doing. And I always wanted people to continue that work. And so I think part of why I wrote this piece was to actually, get people to think about these issues. Like, I'm not sure I have the answer to them. I have enough of a hypothesis, and I had a series of pilot studies that are very relevant, but there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And part of it was I kept hearing these news reports again about the Oculus Rift. Everybody was just like, oh, sickness here, sickness there, it'll be solved here, there, or that, whatnot. And I'm like, no, I don't think it will, because these same basic problems that I identified, 15 years ago, I kept still seeing. And so I'm really hopeful that somebody will really dive in and try to see what's going on, because I suspect there is differences, and I suspect it's even more complicated than, you know, my original studies show.
Yeah, it's one of those things you don't want. It sounds sexist to even study. The whole idea of there being a difference in genders sounds sexist. But if people, but I, by the way, Oculus Rift makes me sick too. So
no, I mean, I think
it makes a lot of men sick.
Oculus Rift in particular has a lot of different issues in terms of cue conflict. This is just one facet of it. But I think part of it is to realize that, you know, we have the highest level of sex hormones on our retina as anywhere else in our body except the gonads.
Isn't that interesting?
Weird.
Yeah.
Right? Like, why?
Yeah.
No one knows. So I think that this is where biology is a very funny beast on this. It's like, for some reason, you know, these hormones are affecting our systems and our vision, but we don't always know why. You really see it when you talk to people who transition, you know, who do gender transitions, because you see them talking about changes in vision that are really startling to them. So there's something going on there, and I think that requires really doing some deep investigation rather than assuming that if we put these technologies out there, they'll just work for everybody. Because I don't think that they will.
Yeah.
And I think the challenge in our industry is that we don't tend to test these kinds of tools on diverse populations.
No, just like medicine. It's all tested on men.
Yeah.
Somebody from the Air Force said you put a cold, wet washcloth in the back of your neck and it helps with this. I don't know. You talk about, which is very interesting, the two ways we perceive three dimensions. And one way tends to be a male centered, or men are better at, one way women are better at. And of course, it's the one that women don't handle so well that is primarily used by virtual reality systems.
So it's more complicated than that, because it's two cues of many cues. We actually have a ton of cues about how we calculate depth perception. But the two cues that became relevant to my study that I was really analyzing were motion parallax, which is really computationally easy to reproduce, and shape from shading, which is much harder to computationally reproduce. So this is also where it's not so simple as to say, oh, we're just not designing for shape from shading because, like, we're lazy. Actually, no, it's really technically difficult, because part of it is that our eyes constantly flicker, and this is how we actually recalculate shape from shading. But when you're actually in an immersive system where they're trying to project onto you where your eye is targeted, it doesn't calculate that constant shifting. And that is, we just don't know how to do that computationally right now. And so this is one of the reasons why I want us to look into this, because I'm not sure that we even have the tools to, you know, get past the cue conflict issue that I saw that seems to be hormone related. I should also say that it's not so clean as to saying all men are this and all women are that.
Right.
It seems to be, you know, these bell curves. At least that's what my early studies found. And there's a tremendous amount of overlap in terms of which one you would prioritize, but that they're, you know, the median is, of course, different, and the mean is different.
Right. As I said, I get sick, and that doesn't mean I'm a girl. Or maybe I am. You ever think of that?
Possibly you have higher levels of estrogen.
I might. So you've been working on It's Complicated. This is your first solo book, and you've been working on this like your whole career, basically, right?
Well, it's been a decade.
Which is long kind of time.
Crazy.
Yeah,
it's been a long time.
What do you think are the most important lessons that we? Oh, so there's different audiences for this. There's, of course, parents who are trying to understand what the hell's going on with their kids, but there's also technologists. The audience you're speaking to today, people who design systems, people who are interacting with systems, people who are enthusiastic and participate heavily in systems. What are the lessons for those of us who are enthusiasts in this?
So, I mean, I think some of the interesting bits that come out of it first have to do with consolidation of, social media, which is that, you know, part of our industry is that we, you know, are determined to make something that fits for everybody and can be scaled to the entire population.
Yeah.
But when it comes to social, people don't want to hang out with everybody they've ever met. That's just awkward, right? And so we keep seeing this, you know, in the tools that we build, is that we will build these things that will be used by everybody, and then we're surprised when people start to leave them.
Right.
And this happens over and over again. The other thing I think is going to be really prescient and important for today is that we've become so obsessed with monetizing social media through data, right? And this obsession about having all of this data kept around. But what we're starting to see is places where that's cracking, right? Snapchat is probably one of the most interesting of them. And, you know, people don't give credit to Snapchat of why it's interesting, right?
Adults assume it's sexting.
Yeah.
No, my kids don't use it for that at all.
No. They use it for two reasons, which I think are really important. The first is the fact that, like, why do you want to keep everything you've ever, you know, photographed? Like, it's just not that interesting, right? And so it's like, why should everything stick around for forever? Let's just make it funny in this moment now without having to try to explain what made it interesting, you know, a month from now. So that idea of making things ephemeral again is really intriguing in light of a world in which we've assumed persistence. But there's another thing that's really beautiful about Snapchat, which is that in a world where you're constantly inundated with streams, right? You think about Instagram, you think about Twitter, you're just like, overwhelming quantities of streams. You know, we've seen different approaches to this, right? Facebook has decided algorithmically that it will determine what, you know, it thinks you will find most interesting or relevant, right? But people are like, I'm not sure I want to buy into its algorithmic determination. Or, you know, something like Twitter, which is going to give you everything and you have to figure out how you're going to deal with it, maybe through third-party services or maybe, you know, just, you know, sucking it up and seeing the stream whenever you see it. Snapchat changes that game entirely. Basically, it says, you have 7 seconds or whatever to pay attention to this image or video. That's it. And so you see young people basically saying, huh, I don't have time to really pay attention to this video right now, so I'm not even going to open it.
Right.
And when they're ready to it, then they know that they're going to pay attention.
Right.
That's intriguing in a world where people are not paying attention to the constant stream of content. And so the thing I think becomes interesting about what young people do with social media is in some ways they push the edges, they push the boundaries of, you know, what these systems are designed to be used for, right? It says, oh, you can only use it this one way. And teenagers are like, nah, forget that. I'm going to use it in some other crazy way.
That's, of course, the history of technology and the history of hacking.
Absolutely.
Is it
and
never...
when you're paying it, exactly. And when you're paying attention to what people do with it,
right.
That's where, you know, beautiful innovations, you know,
sure.
emerge.
Twitter, that's where the @reply came from, the hashtag. They didn't
Absolutely.
Invent it. Users invented it.
Well, I mean, and users, it was geeky users coming back from the past, right? Like, these are old tropes.
It was, actually, yeah.
And so part of it is to appreciate the fact that you can look to weird things that people are doing to start to imagine new paths forward. But at the same time, I think the other big lesson from my book for this crowd is to realize that we tend to only pay attention to the most privileged users that are just like us. And actually, there's a whole diversity of practices in here that we kind of ignore because we isolate it and say, oh, well, those people won't matter. And we tend to focus on such a, you know, small segment of the crowd. You know, things like Snapchat, you know, it made total sense to me when it came out because I've been spending so much time with Black and Latino youth and their practices. They were already messing with Facebook to try to make it more real time.
Hmm.
So, of course, it made sense. This is where it's like, you know, for those who are building new technologies, start paying attention to crowds that are not your crowd. And that's where you'll start to get, you know, opportunities or ideas of how to build new technologies that are not like yet another X.
It does strike me Facebook might have learned this lesson. That's why they bought WhatsApp. It's why they wanted to buy Snapchat. They realize, I think Mark's young enough and smart enough to realize that you need to look at these, how other people are using it from your group, because they may give you ideas. Snapchat sounds like it's about, I want to manage it. I want to manage not only, it's not merely manage my privacy, I want to manage my attention. I want to, you know, I want more control over what's going on. And it's very hard to assert control over Facebook. It's for anybody.
And that's where you start to realize that what privacy is it's not about, you know, the control of the flow of information. That's too simplistic. That's too technological. You can't solve this for access and control lists because all it takes is your mom looking over your shoulder and everything changes.
Right.
And so what you see is that young people are trying to achieve privacy by trying to control the social situation, which means that they're trying to control not just who gets access to content, but who gets access to meaning. And meaning becomes the more important facet in all of this, right? So you see people encoding things, right? Hiding in plain sight, messing with systems, you know, using different kinds of references in all sorts of funny ways. Like, nowhere that does this make me more entertained than watching the conversations around big data, where these companies think they know what's going on with their, you know, the use of their brand, and they have no clue, right? So, you know, I'll deal with it with, you know, for example, teenagers figured out that if they put brand names into their Facebook status updates, that they were more likely to get through the technology filters that, you know, Facebook was putting up. So you'd see these posts like, hey, what's up, Nike? And you're like, what?
I right?
Like,
love
that's
it.
Crazy. But it's like you totally see them messing with the system.
Love that.
Right? I saw these teenagers like having fun with, you know, for example, Gmail. Nothing is funnier if you're 15 than getting your friends to get diapers ads, right? That's awesome. So it's just like, let's mess with the tech so your friends can get stupid ads. You know, or, you know, brands like Coca-Cola who are like, think that they're like the most popular thing ever, but that's not the Coke people are referencing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you're just, so I see this over and over again from companies who think they understand how their brands fit into things, you know, what the text means. And, you know, teenagers are messing with it in all sorts of funny ways.
Good.
And I think that's, I mean, I think it's great.
That gives me hope.
Oh, yeah. Teenagers want privacy, right? Like, they want to be a part of public life. And I think that's the distinction that needs to be made. They want to be in public, but that doesn't mean they want to be public, right? They want to be a part of public life, but they don't want everybody in their business. And so they're trying to find a way to balance those two things, and it's not easy.
You've said that the teenagers have a completely different relationship and understanding of what privacy is than we as adults. Almost the opposite that adults have.
Well, it's that, you know, they're trying to, you know, figure out how they can navigate the world, that they want to be, you know, a part of this public life that I was referring to, but they're so used to surveillance, right? Their parents are always looking over their shoulder. Law enforcement is there, teachers are there, college admissions officers, military recruiters. And so they're constantly trying to think about how they can be a part of public life without, you know, tipping off all of those other folks. And that means they have to really get, you know, creative and finding ways to achieve, you know, privacy in light of all of this. And they often use systems in ways that are never expected. So, for example, you know, at the time that, you know, Facebook was really popular amongst teenagers and Twitter was really popular amongst journalists, I kept seeing teenagers use Twitter all the time because they saw it as more private than Facebook, right? Because Facebook, they had reached a point where they had to be friends with everybody they'd ever met. And there was nothing private about that, no matter how many features Facebook would implement. Whereas Twitter allowed them to just have their closest and dearest, right? And these things iterate and evolve. And I think it's one of the reasons why we see such a proliferation right now of different tools, so that young people can actually separate out different social contexts in a way that's viable. And it's not simply about trying to, you know, restrict some people from these sites. It's like saying, hey, you know what? If I want to talk obsessively about One Direction, here's the place where I'm going to do that. If I want to talk with my friends about fashion, here's the place where I'm going to do that. And you sort of see these segmentations that make a whole lot of sense. But, you know, adults sort of sit there, oh, like, what's the next big thing in social media? It's like, actually, I think that it's going to be about, you know, not one thing, but a whole proliferation of lots of different small things. What that means for the business, you know, for the industry, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, Snapchat, okay, that's big. So we're going to do this whole new thing of destructing media. Like, that's the point of it. And if we just copy what the kids are doing today, we've got a business. And it clearly doesn't work that way. I mean, I love it.
We know we're in a bubble.
We're in a bubble. I love it.
That's a bar.
Go ahead.
I was just saying that's the part of what this looks like, is like when we get obsessed with copying things rather than innovating, we know we're in a bubble around this topic. And I'm not saying, you know, holistically, but I'm saying part of it is, you know, break through and try to create new kinds of interaction paradigms. That's where we see things make sense. We're trying to fill, you know, gaps. So, for example, the reason that these texting apps are so popular is that, you know, the carriers have gotten really greedy, right? The carriers are saying, we're going to make you pay, you know, extraordinary amounts of money to send things over data that costs them next to nothing, right? It became their cash cow.
SMS,
and so all of these texting apps popped up. And it became totally logical, right, that we see this. Now, the question is, are these interesting platforms that we can then iterate on top of? And that's still in many ways to be determined. Everybody's got a lot of speculation about where they go, but they're not, I wouldn't say they're necessarily sticky in the same way as other forms of social media.
I'm sure people hammer on your door and say, Dana, what's the next big thing? What can we do to capitalize on this? It sounds like it's unpredictable, or is it?
It's absolutely unpredictable. If it was predictable, you know, there'd be a lot of people making a lot of money, right? Part of what's really tricky about it all is that it's not a meritocracy. This is not about the best technology. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, it's about the technology that fits into a set of practices and can proliferate, you know, through networks. I think it's also one of the reasons why, you know, the dynamics of what happens when big companies put out new, you know, features, like, for example, Facebook at this point, they can put out a new feature and it can reach millions of people. But if people, you know, find that sort of as an onslaught, they're not necessarily going to embrace it. And I think this is why they've struggled with things like, you know, Poke or, you know, all of these other attempts to replicate other tools. Because it's not just about having that be, you know, the new feature of Facebook. It's about it being, you know, ingrained into people's practices, them feeling like it's different and subtle. And that grassrootsness is really important. But building that grassroots dynamic, you know, easily, like, sort of fluidly, is very, very difficult, and more difficult now that you've got, you know, all sorts of people in the tech industry hovering, looking for the next thing, because they end up blowing up services before they can actually work their way through the social dynamics.
Yeah.
I think that's tricky with tech journalists, because I think that when tech journalists cover things, they often mess up the whole ecosystem.
Oh, no. Because we give it too much attention? We give the wrong things too much attention? Or?
Well, and you get a lot of people to try it out, not because it fits into their friend group,
right,
but because they've heard about it as a cool thing.
Right.
And so then they jump onto it, you know, and see the obsession rather than it flowing naturally through their networks.
So the better way would be just to listen to what your friends are doing and just and do that.
But it's a question of how do you flow new technologies like comfortably through that, right?
Right?
And what happens when these things get normalized, right? So, for example, take something like Secret, right? You know, that thing popped in the tech sector so fast. And what it meant is that, you know, most people who would come onto the service saw it as a gossip platform
for Silicon Valley. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It was just like, and so then that was the norm, and that's what they posted. It was either that or, you know, sex-related comments.
Right.
And so the thing is that it's hard to break out of that, you know, that gutter in many ways to find a new practice for something that, you know, it could have gone in a bazillion different directions, but those early adopter populations shaped it all.
It's actually, that's a really excellent point. The Secret could have been something that teenagers would love, but they're not going to get a chance to because we've already put it in this box and they're not going to it now. It's like, well, it's a bunch of tech.
But it's also
jerks.
That, you know, if they happen to get on it, they're going to get onto it from a particular network.
Right.
And that's going to be a weird version of it. And
right.
that makes it hard for that company, right? Like, they're in a challenging place. You know, and then, you know, the way that Whisper plays out is different than the way that Yik Yak plays out. I mean, like, these are all systems that are similar, but the dynamics of who those early adopters are and who in your network shaped it really affect it. And that was true for every form of social media, but we forget this because we only paid attention to things once they were hot.
Right. And a bad idea. So Yik Yak, I'm going to write that down, and I'll destroy them next.
I mean, it's a really tricky thing, I will say, for you, is like, how do you cover these things in a way where you talk about the different aspects of it without really radically shaping the culture? And I mean, I say this as a researcher and as a blogger. I'm often very, very careful about covering things that I see, and I won't mention many services to journalists early on because I want to see how they'll play out, and I know that it becomes too visible, that changes everything.
Well, it's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Observation just changes things. And
it's
unfortunately,
great to know that physics continues to affect everything.
Unfortunately, my job is observation. So your job is a little different because you know, it means nothing for me to know about something and not talk about it. That's not that's you. That's like, well, that's personal then. It has nothing to do with my business. So my job is to talk about stuff. And you know what? All I do, and I think, I don't know if this is true of all tech journalists, but I just talk about stuff that I like. And what really happens is, so that's stuff that my network, my social network, which happens to be all people who are participating in our network, I'm talking to them. But I acknowledge that can have a very deleterious effect on some of these things, but hey, that's life. What are you going to do, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tricky because it means that the way, you know, way these things play out is often unexpected. I mean,
yes.
I don't think it's that surprising that Snapchat was sitting in L.A. far away from Silicon Valley.
Right.
Right? And that's also where I think that some of the most interesting stuff is, you know, in social is probably going to happen outside of Silicon Valley, not inside, because it flows too fast inside.
I agree. And that's, by the way, why very consciously we're not in San Francisco. We're in Petaluma, an hour north, because I want to get out of the bubble a little bit. You need to be near it to cover it. But I think, and I don't go to parties. I don't want to talk to those people because I don't want to hear the buzz in Silicon Valley. It is. It's very different. Very different from the rest of the world.
And there's certain innovations that can only happen in that kind of high, dense environment.
Absolutely.
But we just don't acknowledge the ones that can't happen in there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Hey, boy, this is fascinating stuff. Dana Boyd is our guest. One more commercial, then we'll have one more segment with Miss Boyd. I really appreciate your time, and I just this stuff is fascinating to me. And thank goodness, I have to say, you play a very important role, because as tech journalists, we have a very different job, right? But as a sociologist, you have the more important job, which is to really kind of try to understand what's happening, and still report on it. I mean, you're writing a book; it's not like you're keeping it a complete secret.
No. I share it, but part of it is that I share it in order to help inform, you know, people more generally. It's
That's
less
right.
about trying to hit the hot new trend.
That's right. I don't care about the hot new trend either. You're absolutely right on that. Our show today brought to you by LegalZoom.com. Not a law firm, a great company, though, that helps you start your business, take care of your family, do the trademark, your brand, do the stuff you need to do without high-priced law firm. It's modern technology. We love it. Smartphones, iPads, gadgets, social media. When it comes time to get legal help, if you're starting a business, I know you're busy. I know there's a lot of signals coming into your brain. Just remember this. You can go to LegalZoom for a very affordable price. You can create an LLC. This is what we did, $99 plus the filing fees. You walk through a questionnaire. It's actually really easy. Incorporating with Chapter S or C or creating a trademark. If you're a blogger, you probably should trademark your name, your logo. We trademarked Twit and the Twit logo. $169. It's easy to do. I want to say that. You can create, of course, a last will and testament, a durable power of attorney, a health care directive. That's pretty important. They even have a pet directive. What's to happen with your pets? LegalZoom.com. Now, if you need an attorney, they also have this great legal plan. They've contracted with attorneys in every state for a flat rate to give you legal advice. So that's really handy. You can read the profiles of the attorneys, but also unedited reviews from their customers to get an idea of who's right for you. LegalZoom, they've been around for 14 years now, A-plus from the Better Business Bureau. They really do, I think, a vital service. They provide legal help through independent attorneys, self-help services, not a law firm. Visit LegalZoom.com. Use our offer code Triangulation. You'll save on your legal needs. You'll get those legal plan attorneys if you need them. I wish I had, because I wasn't sure whether I should do Chapter S or C or LLC. I just made it up. Actually, it worked out fine. LegalZoom.com. Use the offer code Triangulation. Let them know you heard about it here. We'll give you $10 off your purchase at LegalZoom.com. Dana Boyd is our guest. Her new book, It's Complicated. You've been touring universities. Stanford, you just were at Brown. Must have been fun to go to your alma mater.
I think of it kind of as a thank you tour. It's all the folks who've been really awesome to me. I need to go back and say thank you.
You know, you mentioned Andy and, his history and his influence. Andy Hertzfeld studied with him. Randy Pausch studied with him. I mean, a hugely influential professor at Brown. There even is a rumor that the Toy Story character, Andy,
yeah,
is named after him because the Pixar folks studied with him.
Half of Pixar is from Brown.
Yeah, I love that.
I mean, and that's the thing, is it really shaped the graphics world. And I'll never forget, I think it was Andy's 70th birthday party, where a group of folks in the Bay Area decided to throw a surprise party and just see who would come, and managed to get 150 former students to all show up.
Wow.
And I mean, people love Andy. He was a very hard professor when you were a student, but boy, he's sort of your best friend going forward. And he's the kind of professor that made me want to stay in academia to begin with.
Is he still teaching or is he retired?
Oh, he's still teaching.
Wow.
And he's not going to retire.
Wow, that is pretty cool. He also in the late 60s worked with Ted Nelson on the very first hypertext system. So here's a guy whose influence has been felt widely. It's so cool. What I guess, I'm looking at the website for It's Complicated, dana.org, dana.org. And you talk about paternalism and protectionism and how we as adults who want to protect our kids, it's probably not the best thing to do.
I mean, the hardest thing to realize is that, the responsibility that we have as parents is to help children go from the very dependent stages of, say, infancy and toddler years to being independent adults, right? Ideally, that's what you're aiming for. And that transition is often very rocky, and it's most notable in the teenage years, because part of it is that you want to protect young people from all of the risks of the world, especially the things that you don't understand, right? And that's where technology comes in, because if you don't understand it, you're really concerned about it. But the challenge is, how do you give young people sort of free rein, opportunities to go explore, experiment, to figure out the world as they fit into it? And that process is really, really difficult. And it's very challenging for parents because they don't quite understand how they can navigate it in ways where they know their kids will come out okay.
We want them to take risks. We want them to fail and make mistakes. We just don't want it to be permanent, like life-changing or life-ending mistakes.
I mean, and that's the irony, of course, is that we love risks in certain domains, right? That we love when young people are in the tech sector and taking great risks in their entrepreneurship. We like when, those who will go into the military will risk their lives, for us as a nation. But we don't want them to take risks that we deem as unworthy as an adult, right? And this is where it's a really difficult fine line of who gets to make those decisions about which risks are, legitimate and which ones aren't. And part of it is that teenagers rightfully see the hypocrisy in a lot of the stuff that comes out of our mouths. I mean, this is true even things like sexting, right? Which you mentioned earlier, where you know, teenagers look at their parents and are just like, you know, you guys are the problem. You guys are the ones that have problems with sexting. Like,
yeah.
First off, it's like, you know, what politician, you know, one after the other, right? And you, they're your elected officials. And you're
that's what we
run.
Would do if we had Snapchat.
It's like, okay, great. Ew. I mean, I think, you know, they're right to point out is like, you know, or take meanness and cruelty. I mean, we've turned meanness and cruelty into sport, right? Yeah. This is our political landscape. This is our reality TV. So that's where I think there's a lot of teenagers who scratch their heads and are like, what are you guys talking about? It's you guys that have the problem, not us. And they have a point, right? And that doesn't mean that there aren't young people who won't suffer consequences from what goes on online, right? And I think that's where it's really difficult because life isn't fair. It is not a meritocracy. It is not that, you know, everything will work out, you know, fine for you or that, you know, your risks will be legitimated and others won't, right? It's this really difficult balance and trying to figure out how to navigate that is one of the hardest things to do. And so we, as a result, we say, okay, let's do everything possible to protect young people from everything we can imagine. But that's not a way to come of age. That's not a way to encourage the kinds of creativity that go on. And I think this is where, you know, in the tech sector, many of the young people who are really shaping the tech sector, they took a lot of risks themselves, especially as young people online, right? They used the internet to get to know all sorts of other geeks. This is how they learned their trade long before they went to, you know, to a formalized educational platform for it. Right. And I think that's why it's really, really tricky is that, you know, in the tech sector, we kind of know it. We know how valuable those interest-driven practices can be. And so then, you know, we start having these conversations of just like, oh, you know, drop out of school or, you know, you're in Silicon Valley. And it's like, it's not that simple. It's all about being a part of these networks. And I think this is where, you know, as we talk about some of the gender issues we've got in Silicon Valley, we allow our young boys to take a lot more risks than we allow our young girls to do. Right. And so they're not actually socialized into the kinds of culture and practices that we take for granted in our industry.
Your next talk is in Rockville, Maryland at the Walter Johnson High School PTA.
Yep.
That's a lucky PTA.
I've been trying to do some more different kinds of parenting events, and I've done, you know, a handful of them throughout this tour. And, you know, it's always a challenge because, you know, at the end of the day, my invitation to a lot of parents is please calm down, right? You know, it's like if you want to help your kids, you have to actually figure out how to make certain that they can ask critical questions of what they're doing, how they can, you know, figure out how to navigate these spaces on their own. It's not about fear mongering. And unfortunately, they're surrounded by fear mongering at this point.
Good, good, good. And I think we should all talk to the PTAs and tell them it's going to be okay.
Well, I mean, I'd certainly invite a lot of the folks on, you know, who are listening here to, you know, help educate your PTAs about technology, right?
Like, calm down. So you're hoping to be a parent yourself.
I am a parent.
Oh, you are? Congratulations. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And
how
my
old?
Son is tiny. He's 9 months old today.
Oh, congratulations. That's wonderful. So I think some parents might say, oh, yeah, Dana, wait till you have a teenager. See what you do. Are you a little nervous about that?
No, actually, I'll say, you know, everybody's always said, oh, well, you know, when you have a kid, it'll change your research. It's like, no, I actually rigorously went about this research. I'm not worried about my research.
Right.
The thing that I will say is that my research has really shaped what I think about parenting. And it's made me really realize that, you know, my biggest challenge is to stay calm in light of all of the, you know, different anxieties that I might, you know, encounter, of which there are many, right?
Yes.
Like, I'm not necessarily an inherently calm person.
Yes.
And I think it's a lot about really appreciating and learning from my son and helping him navigate these worlds. And he'll run into all sorts of bumps and bruises. I can pretty much guarantee it. But part of it is to figure out how to help him navigate that in the best way possible. But I think the thing that's really helped me along this research is that, you know, two of my colleagues that I've, you know, been part of large networks with, including one of the co-authors of the Hanging Out book you referred to, you know, they had children at different ages throughout the projects that we've been working on. And so I got to watch them navigate the world of research versus the, you know, dynamics in their own home, right? And it's this reminder of the fact that actually research helps inform us as parents more than us as parents necessarily helps us inform us as researchers.
Yes.
Because really, in the scheme of things, my kid's going to be extraordinarily privileged, right?
Yes.
And I'm grateful for that. And I think he's very lucky. And I'm much more concerned about the young people who don't have the kinds of opportunities, privilege, and, you know, engaged parents that, you know, my son does.
Right on. Right on. That's really true. And I have learned so much from my kids. And I admittedly, it's anecdotal. You're doing rigorous research. But I just watching them, it's really clear that their take on all this is very different in some ways, you know, less involved and less interested than I am.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the other thing is I'll never forget this one woman that I met, you know, not as part of, she was not one of my research subjects, but I met her and she was just, you know, she was complaining about her dad, you know, as teenagers do. And she was just like, oh, he doesn't understand technology. He doesn't understand this. He doesn't understand that. And I was listening to her and I was sort of appreciating it. And then I figured out that her father is one of the more famous venture capitalists working in the sector. And I was just like, oh honey.
Boy.
There's these weird reminders, right? There's what you understand about technology is very different than what your kids do.
Yeah.
And it's just different, right?
Yeah.
Because the thing is that they know how to use this to fulfill certain kinds of social dynamics. You know this at a more meta picture, at a technological picture, mm-hmm. but you're not using it in the same way they are.
Right.
And so it's about learning from each other. And it's really hard to figure that out because especially as adults in this society, we're always convinced that we know best rather than saying actually what we know is just different.
Well, and what I've really learned is that the details of the modern age are different, but the underlying needs, the underlying drives, they haven't changed.
Right, and
humans
teenagers
are
as varied as adults, right?
Right?
Which is to say that there are really shy ones, and there
right.
are really, you know, extremely expressive ones, and I think that's also weird is that as parents, especially in single, you know, in households, parents want their kids to interact with technology as they imagine they would,
yes.
without realizing that their kids have different personalities than they do,
yes,
different priorities, different interests, and part
that.
Of it is to support that.
They had no interest in any of the stuff I was doing. Hey, Dana, it's such a thrill to meet you and to talk to you. Dana is Zephoria on Twitter, well worth following, Zephoria. Her new book, It's Complicated, is in bookstores now, The Social Lives of Network Teens, 10 years of research on how young people view technology, interact with technology, how technology is shaping their lives, everything from privacy, bullying, you know, it's a different world for them, and it's a really interesting read to know. The world that they're living in. And I want to really honor your point that it's the have-nots, the underprivileged kids, the marginalized kids that we really need to pay attention to.
Yeah.
And they're the ones for whom, in some cases, these technologies are the only outlet, the only savior, the only... And so this is really an interest. It's a very different point of view.
And I hope that our industry pays more attention to those who are really suffering and finds new
yeah.
innovative ways of connecting
yeah.
young people to people who can help them. Because there's a lot of young people who are really suffering out there, but they're more often not than the kids that are, you know, not necessarily from the most privileged of communities.
Right.
And so I think
right.
that's where we, you know, have a disconnect.
Right.
So it's about all of us taking a moment to pay attention to what's happening outside of our own homes
yes.
and in our broader communities.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Dana.org, DANAH.org is Dana's website. Dana, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Really great to talk to you. I hope we can do it again. If you don't mind, I'd love to get you back.
By all means.
Okay. Thank you, Dana. It's
Take
complicated.
Care.
Take care. Bye-bye. We do Triangulation now on Tuesday mornings. It's the first show of the week. I'm sorry, Monday mornings, first show of the week. 11 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. I'm sorry, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. I love it if you watch live. I'm watching the chat room. And your feedback is very valuable. You give me great ideas for questions. But if you can't, we always make on-demand audio and video available after the fact at our website, twit.tv/TRI, on the mobile apps, on every platform. I just downloaded Dimitri Lialin's Windows Phone Twit app. It's great. Highly recommend using the apps or iTunes, whatever, Xbox Music, whatever it is that you use to subscribe to podcasts. If you subscribe, you get it every week, and you don't miss a show. Lots of great people on the show. It's really fun. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you next time on Triangulation.